Well, Bill's presentation really shed some important light on this issue. When we think about, for years, when we've those of us who think about pharmacoepidemiology and the safety of medications have struggled with the notion that for these medications, and particularly antipsychotics, we don't know a lot about whether they work, and we don't know a lot about whether they harm children. And so we've always been sort of in the wilderness saying, you know, there's a lot of increasing use of these drugs, as the next presentation will share for us. And Bill's presentation really helps to begin to add additional information as we've gotten over the years about the clear risks from use of these medications in children. But I want to think about this in terms of balance, right? So I'm a pediatrician, and most Tuesday mornings you can find me in the Vanderbilt Outpatient Primary Care Center, where I take care of kids from our urban population, immigrant families, as well as children from rural parts of Tennessee who don't have access to health care much. And so on a Tuesday morning, my best Tuesdays are when I get to go to clinic and take care of these children and then go back to my office and think about the myriad of public health problems that they present and how we might, on a population level, address those. And so it's a great Tuesday when I can do that. So I want to share with you one particular Tuesday that I had. And this was a Tuesday that an 8-year-old male was referred to our clinic from a rural community in Tennessee, about 90 miles east of Nashville. And he came in to be evaluated for weight gain. He was reported by his family to have gained 20% of his weight in the past 6 months. And the family was quite concerned about this. His past medical history, he had asthma, he had attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, and conduct disorder. When the nurse brought him back and reported his medications, he was on albuterol to treat his asthma. He was also on risperidone. And that was when I began to scratch my head. This has been several years ago. And I was like, okay, now why is this child on risperidone? I don't believe he's psychotic. There's nothing that sort of would suggest that. He doesn't appear to be on the autism spectrum. And so I talked with the mom a little bit about what was going on, and there had been a fair amount of aggressive behavior that this child had exhibited in school. And she said to me, we didn't have any other choice. He was about to get kicked out of school. I would have lost my job. We had no other choice, and there's no mental health resources in Red Boiling Springs, the community where they live. And so she was really stuck in the middle of trying to decide what to do. And when you think then about the healthcare professional who was providing care for this child, there was a balance beam for the individual patient. So we're going to think about the balance beam for individual patients and then the balance beam from a public health perspective to think about this, and that'll segue into the next couple of presentations. So for the healthcare professional, because actually I was so struck by this and did a series of studies after this to try to understand this problem on a population level, including the work that I collaborated with Bill on, I called social workers in the community. I called the healthcare professional who prescribed these medications. I talked to teachers. And what happens is that the balance beam of sort of what do I do with this child who's about to kick out of school? Do I prescribe an antipsychotic? My friend who lives over two communities away, the professional said, had a kid who was really aggressive, was about to get kicked out of school. He put him on risperidone and it worked like a charm. So that notion of ends of one, the bane of our existence as public health professionals, that stories are really important, but without data to support them are only stories. There was an increasing choice of medications, and there was a perception at that time, this was about 2004, that Haldol and other type 1 or sort of first-generation antipsychotics, which had been used for years, have really serious and debilitating side effects, neurologic side effects. And so you would never, no one would ever put a child on Haldol in this kind of setting because of the known side effects. And there was this perception that these second-generation antipsychotics were helpful and also had no side effects because they didn't have the neurologic side effects. The other challenge is that in addition to access to these medications, having a friend whose child was helped by it, there's not many mental health resources in many of the places where we work. And so having access and the patients, so when you need 8 to 12 sessions for cognitive behavioral therapy to begin to be effective, sometimes by the time you get that far down the road, there's not time, or there's not perceived time, I would argue differently, that there's a demand from the school. teachers call me all the time. You have to put this kid on Ritalin. He's driving me crazy. I cannot get anything done in my classroom. So I have an opportunity for education whenever that happens. So there's a lot of challenges that would lead, and these were some of the factors that this healthcare professional shared with me. Other treatments, it's not known whether these medications, the balance beam in favor of trying other things, we don't know whether these antipsychotics work. These stories would suggest it, but there's a lot of use in Susan's study and that she'll share with us, but also in others, that suggest that these meds are being used for things like attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, where there are other medications that have clear efficacy and other behavioral therapies that have clear efficacy. In balance beam, there is a potential for harm, but until we've had more recent data, there's not a lot of evidence to suggest that. And so it's an individual practitioner struggling with trying to balance that. And so when oftentimes what happened, and clearly what every curve you draw that shows antipsychotic prescribing for kids looks like this. What that is suggesting is that as individual families and individual healthcare professionals are facing these decisions, they're coming down on the side of using these medications. And what I would suggest is that when we think about this from a public health perspective, there needs to be something addressed, particularly when you think about these are not without harm. I'm not an anti-medication person. You know, if you have a child with a mental health disorder and there's a clear indication and you need medication, they can be extremely useful. But you need the right medication for the right child at the right time. And so one of the things that when we think then about a public health approach to this issue and how we might address it when we look at the significant increases in prescribing for indications that are not warranted in many, many cases, we have to sort of think about, well, do we do nothing about this? We just allow this to increase, recognizing that some of these, the diabetes in particular, have lifelong implications for these children. So in terms of from a public health perspective, the balance beam of do nothing, well, there's a lot of things going on. You know, if I'm at a state health department, or I'm at a Medicaid agency, or I'm an insurer, or I'm at a mental health agency, there's a lot of things that sort of compete for my interest. We would argue that this is an important one from a child perspective, from a prescribing perspective, from a pharmacoepidemiologic perspective. Oftentimes I find in my work with the FDA and in my work with TennCare, which is Tennessee's Medicaid program, there's these regulatory boundaries around public health professionals around, well, I can't tell prescribers what to do. As a pediatrician, nearly every medication, every prescription I write is off-label, technically, because there's not studied indications in some children for even commonly prescribed antibiotics. And so the notion, the ability to then affect that, crosses into regulatory boundaries that people are often uncomfortable facing. It costs something to address. Oftentimes, there is the concern that there's limited evidence of harm. So when you think about balance, another balance beam is harm, risks, and benefits. There's limited evidence. We're beginning to stack up evidence that would support a public health response. And oftentimes there's a political response. There are people who are advocating from several different fronts about increasing the use of these medications. How about doing something? Dr. Bobo's study, Dr. Osri's study that she'll sort of share about particularly vulnerable children in the foster care program suggests that not only are we not sure these medications help, there's emerging evidence that these medications can be harmful to kids. We don't know. We just don't have sufficient evidence to know that some of these behaviors, aggressive behavior, there has been some response in children with autism. But a typical child who has attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, there are other choices. Educational opportunities, the opportunity to educate professionals and families and education professionals and mental health professionals really give us an opportunity. And then particularly an argument towards doing something would come from the potential long-term consequences of doing nothing. And so what I would urge us to do in this conversation today, and particularly tomorrow as we continue this dialogue, is to think, if we don't do something about this, other people are doing things. And so I really think we need to think as we place this in context about our balance beam as healthcare professionals and our passion for, particularly in my case and your case, many of you, our passion for children and vulnerable children that we serve or we think of and why we come to work every day, that there's something we can do and should do.
I think that from that very nice overview, we can kind of begin to understand that there are a lot of competing interests with regard to prescribing pediatric psychotropic medication use. And a lot of that is uncertainty around what is going on, what do I need to do now, and what are the implications of not doing anything. And so to the extent that that really leads, that decision-making in the era of uncertainty leads to a lot of the variability that we have been observing in there's been increase, but there hasn't been increase in use for everybody, and it's not been balanced. And so I think it was a nice kind of entree to a population of children in foster care, which has received a lot of attention from individuals across the U.S. and from the federal government around what's happening with treatment of psychiatric conditions, and particularly use of psychotropic medications. And so I'm going to walk you through a series of different findings that have really led to this interest in understanding some of the treatment sequencing and how do kids end up on these antipsychotics, what's been tried prior to. And I just want to take a moment to acknowledge Mindy Tai, who's a graduate student working in my lab, as well as Wendy Camilla Castillo, who's a postdoctoral fellow, who's helped contribute to the work I'll be presenting today. And Dr. Terry Shaw is the faculty in our School of Social Work and has been an integral member of making this work happen. I do want to just state that, as I said earlier, I don't have any relationships or any information, anything to disclose at this time. I would say that in discussing the antipsychotic use in pediatric populations, that we will be talking about off-label use of these medications. There are very few indications for use of antipsychotics in pediatric populations, and those indications, for the most part, go down to as low as age 10. And just an acknowledgement for funding from the state for the work that I will be presenting. So in my session, I'd like to engage in a discussion around some of the psychotropic treatment patterns that we've been observing among youth in foster care, and really look at some of the treatment sequencing as we're beginning to actually delve into that area and start to really understand how do we know and get to figure out how things play out in the treatment profile prior to using antipsychotic medication, and then looking at some of the stability of medication use over time. So we feel, or we might mistakenly think that medications are used and they just continue on, but there's actually a lot of changes that occur over time, and we want to understand what some of the stability or instability of medication use looks like. So just to put in perspective, I'm not sure how many people are familiar with the foster care population or even with psychotropic use in pediatric populations, but they have been efficacious for some mental health conditions, and as Dr. Cooper noted, when a child needs it, certainly they should have access to treatment, judiciously, of course. And the evidence for the effectiveness of these medications in children is lacking. So we have a lot of clinical trials that show they're efficacious in reducing various symptoms, but we don't have long-term effectiveness. And some of these side effects that emerge that are chronic medical conditions that a child now has to deal with for possibly the rest of their life, that leads to, is that an effective treatment for a child? And then we talked about the side effect profiles when a child is diagnosed early on with diabetes as a result of medication exposure is quite serious condition. So children in foster care are a special population for a number of reasons, and they do have a significant amount of psychiatric impairment just from a lot of the early exposure to potentially trauma and violence, and in households that can be quite unstable for these youth. We also know that these children are 3 to 5 times more likely to be prescribed a psychotropic medication relative to other Medicaid children, and particularly much higher than the commercially insured children. Children have private insurance. And that's been publicized through reports from the Government Accountability Office that have really kind of brought that to the limelight nationally. And we also know that concomitant use of antipsychotics with stimulants has been increasing. And that's some recent work that colleagues and I published just this September. And so while we're increasing the use of antipsychotics among children, it's not just antipsychotics, but it's concomitant use. So if we have safety concerns with them being used as single treatment, we should also be concerned when we start combining two different agents with unknown efficacy and safety profile. The other thing that's important with children in foster care is that they are covered through the Medicaid system, but they also interact with multiple child-serving agencies within a state. And so it's just not a Medicaid kind of situation, but it's also child welfare. And in some cases, unfortunately, it's juvenile services. And so essentially, national mandates have really been put forth that we have collaborations across agencies in overseeing the use of medications, psychotropic medications for this population. As of 2012, some of the work that I've done talking with various states and how they've addressed that mandate, many states are now moving towards putting together a program where there is some oversight and review of medications for kids in foster care. So prior to a medication being filled at a pharmacy, a lot of that has to go through some kind of secondary review for appropriateness. So I wanted to kind of start with a national perspective on what we have seen among use in psychotropic use in foster care. And this work was published in 2012. And this graph here was from 47 states and the District of Columbia. And the prevalence is shown here for the various psychotropic classes. So any psychotropic as well as individual antipsychotic in red, stimulant in green, antidepressant in purple, and then a mood stabilizer in the turquoise blue. And this is a graph for ages 3 to 5 years old, and I just call your attention to the y-axis, and you can see that the percentage of any psychotropic use among this very young population is about 8% over time, and it seems to be stable, and it seems to be decreasing a little bit over time, which is actually fairly high for that young population. And then you see that the stimulant use seems to be stabilizing and decreasing. The one medication that was on the rise was the antipsychotic, which is the red. And so that really raises red flags in such a young population that this medication was increasingly being prescribed. And this is through 2007, so that's even quite dated right now. But the point is that these are started very young. And then when we look at the 6 to 11-year-old, you see how that prevalence increases. Now we're looking at 25 to almost 30% of kids, 6 to 11, who have had any psychotropic medication use and the consistency of that over time. And you see that while some of those other classes are stabilizing or decreasing, the antipsychotic was continually on the rise. And that's 10% of children prevalence, which is also quite high. When we look at the older adolescent teenagers, we see now that the prevalence jumps up to about 35%, 30 to 35. So you get a sense of they're starting young. It's still a high percentage, but that this increases as kids age. And you see clearly the red line for antipsychotic is on the rise. So we've seen these trends, and I think the message is that they start really young. And so one of the subgroup or sub-analysis we did was to focus on very young children to understand what's happening at a very young age. And this work actually was published online in August, will be in print in December in Psych Services. And these were children who we looked at between the ages of 3 and 6. And we looked at children who were involved in foster care for at least 365 days. We had at least a year's worth to observe medication treatment patterns. And so these are 178 children who had received a psychotropic medication. And you see that a slightly higher percentage of the sample was in the 5 to 6 year old range. And I think that 4 to 5 transition seemed to be a very critical time period. You can also see here that there was a significant amount of disruptive behavior disorder, and that a small percentage of these very young children had a psychotherapy visit. So any of the guidelines for preschooler use of psychotropics in preschool advocate that there should be at least 2 trials of a non-pharmacologic intervention prior to. Now, I don't know what happened prior to, but we would hope that that would continue on once they're medicated. But we saw very few kids who had psychotherapy. I want to point out here, this is just looking at the prevalence in 2010 for these children. We break this out by year of age. And the points to really highlight is you look at the antipsychotropic use and you see the big jump in the prevalence from 4 years old to 5 years old. And then if you look at the, so as children age, that prevalence gets higher. But when you look at the jump in the antipsychotic use, that's a huge change in a very, very short period of developmental growth, right? There's a lot that goes on between, you think about somebody who's 3 years old, just starting to talk and do, or actually is forming like, you know, verbal sentences, then 6 years old, you're now in school. And it's a huge growth, and yet we also see a huge growth in these medications. And actually, the antipsychotic growth by year of age seem to be larger than the percentage increase in ADHD medications. And the ADHD medications are what we tend to see, because as kids who have problems with focus and attention, as they hit school, that becomes very problematic for their learning. And so that's when those medications tend to grow. But we saw this in a very young age, particularly at the 4 to 5 year old jump. Then we looked at, well, was this just a one-time only, or was it being used consistently? And so this looks over a three-year period from 2009 to 2011 and tried to capture the duration of treatment. And so the other thing I wanted to point out here is you can see that by the time that they're 6 years old, that these are not things that are being used for a week at a time or a month at a time, but they're being used for a fair number of days. And you see the increase in the use of antipsychotic. So what we might say, okay, maybe there was a trial for a very young child, but by the time they're 6 years old, they're taking these for a significant amount of time, and they're not taking just one by the time they're 6 years old. You see the growth in three or more psychotropic classes. So it's a huge change in that. And this was just looking at the percentage of their time in foster care where medication was actually used. And the point here is, it comes out to be about half that time in foster care. And when we control for other factors, say, well, there are other factors in play here. If you control for their days in foster care, if you control for the demographics and control for some of the other medication exposures, you see that regardless of the for ADHD and antipsychotic medications, with each year increase in age, we saw nearly a doubling increase of receiving these medications for three or more weeks per month. And so what we did in this time-varying analysis is to look over time if the medication was being used for the majority of time in that month, as opposed to a seven-week trial here, or like as needed for addressing maybe an acute exacerbation behavior. And so what we're saying is, as for each year increase in age, the likelihood that these medications are being prescribed for the majority of that month increased or nearly double, which I thought was significant. So given that we just talked about the trends and increase in use over time, that they start young, and when they start young, they stay on board and they're more continuous. That's where it really starts to take a step back and say, well, how do kids actually get on these medications and what's tried prior to? And so we looked at an antipsychotic initiation for kids in foster care. And in this particular subgroup sample, we looked at children age 21 and younger. That's the age that is they're in foster care up through 21 for some transitioning to adult services is why they allow that. And we looked at the time period of January 2010 through March of 2014, and we found that about just under 3,500 youth had received at least one antipsychotic medication during that time period. So 19% of youth in foster care had at least exposure. Then we looked at, we wanted to look at initiators. So we called a new user as no use in the past 6 months, acknowledging that certainly 7, 8, or 10 months ago, they might have had exposure. So this could be a new reinitiator, but there was no antipsychotic use in the past 6 months, and that was about half of those individuals who had had an antipsychotic prescription. We looked at children who were in foster care 6 months prior, and we also looked 200 days after because we were doing some follow-up. And then we excluded children who had schizophrenia or bipolar disorder. And so of the children, of the 581 children that we had some continuous foster care enrollment on, about half of those children were had a diagnosis of ADHD or disruptive behavior disorder, which then kind of mirrors some of these issues with the behaviors in school, and they're going to get kicked out. And these antipsychotics are being prescribed largely for some of these problems. So I want to also point that we found that about only a third, 35% of these children had actually had any other psychotropic medication prior to initiating the antipsychotic, which means that two-thirds of these children did not. And so if we look at guidelines where antipsychotics for some of these disorders should not be the first-line treatment, it really opened up the questions, why were these being used when there hadn't been anything else prior to on board, given what we know about the risks? So we actually did propensity score matching, and I just wanted to highlight that the kids who were new users had higher rates of hospitalization and emergency department visits. So we know that kids who started on these clearly have more significant impairment. And we also saw that very few of these children also had a psychotherapy visit. And it seems to be a pattern that's coming persistent in many places where I've seen these data where these medications are on board, and oftentimes few children have had psychotherapy or non-pharmacologic visit. So I wanted to transition a little bit to looking at the sequencing. So that initial look, and when we found out that about two-thirds of children hadn't had any prior exposure to antipsychotics, then raised a question, well, what does that treatment sequencing look like? So we looked at the same time frame, January 2010 through March of 2014, but we looked for continuous foster care involvement in the year prior to that initial antipsychotic prescription. We looked at children 20 years or younger as of January 2010, and we looked for youth. That index antipsychotic prescription was based on no antipsychotic in the prior 6 months. We then created 12 30-day intervals prior to the antipsychotic. So we broke that 1 year up into 12 periods. Refills within 10 days we combined into the same treatment episode and not called it two different because there's a lot of reasons why people don't get prescriptions filled on time. We counted single drug use within a 30-day interval if it was there for more than 7 days. We wanted to rule out, again, any of these short-term PRN, but really wanted to focus on medications that were probably being used chronically as part of ongoing treatment. And then we defined concomitant use, again, within a 30-day period as greater than or equal to 15 days. Again, that would be the majority of that month where two or more medications were being used together. And so what we were trying to do is create patterns. And we focused on four psychotropic classes that are listed here. This represents about 80 to 90% of most psychotropic use in children. We also wanted to capture other patterns. So sometimes there was a month where there was no medication used, and we wanted to capture that. And other times we saw where there was a tapering, where the medication pattern from a prior month would carry into the next month, but it wouldn't be for much of that next month, and so we wanted to, and it was clearly they were tapering off of that combination. We ended up with 15 different drug combinations. I can tell you our programmer really loved us for that. He said, can you please narrow this down a little bit? And this is what the data looked like when we had it all said and done. And this is just one case, and you can see that the event type is the pattern, the combination or single drug use. And what's highlighted in green is you can see where we had to make decisions, right? So in the seventh month, they had ADHD medication for 9 days, right? And then they had the mood disorder for a mood stabilizer for the 30 days. Because that concomitant use didn't qualify for more than 15 days, we didn't call that a concomitant use pattern month. And so there are pluses and minuses of making these decision calls. But we really wanted to capture what was going on for the most, mostly in that month. This is just a demographic description of the kids 30 days prior to the antipsychotic initiation. So we had 304 children that we were focusing on. What you can see is about 181 of those 304, so it's over 60%, were actually not on any medication prior to the antipsychotic. And that the older kids were the ones that were on one or more than one psychotropic in that 30-day prior. This graph here just shows, it's comparing the percentage of children by these classes in month 12 before initiating antipsychotic and then month 1. And we see that you see a large proportion of the children who were not on psychotropic medications 12 months before starting were also not on medications 1 month just prior to starting. And the patterns of either being not on a drug, on only one psychotropic, or a combination seem to be, didn't change in the 12-month to the 1 month prior. When we look at some of the changes in the drug therapy, this gets a little bit at, if you started on no drug in month 12, what percentage of these children were on a different combination in the 1 month prior? So you see that the majority of those who were not on a psychotropic medication 12 months prior to initiating the antipsychotic were also not on anything 1 month prior. When you look at the children who started in month 12 on an antidepressant or an ADHD medication singly, many were still on a single medication in that 1 month prior, but they may not have been on the same. We're just counting whether they were on they changed their regimen from a single to a multiple. And then those who were on two psychotropic classes, the largest proportion of those remained on two, but they could have switched those two. And so this really is a little bit of work in progress and understanding kind of what those switches are. This is just to kind of give us a sense of how much switching is going on. And so we looked at here the stability. So if you started out as not having a medication on board 12 months prior, what percentage of those children actually went the whole year without a medication before starting antipsychotic? And you can see how high that bar is. I was shocked to see that there was nothing that had, that group didn't whittle away and go on to medication and maybe come back off of it, but a large proportion of these kids were not on anything. And that's a group to understand why. And there could be a very, very good clinical reason why, but, you know, what is the rationale for going straight to an antipsychotic first? And then you see that for the other classes that there's significant fewer kids who actually stayed on that same regimen throughout the year, suggesting that anywhere from 60 to maybe 90% of kids have that switching going on throughout the year and they're not stable on that regimen. Which makes sense to me in the sense that these are very difficult cases to manage clinically, and we don't always have the most effective treatment. So I'm going to go a little bit quickly because these are just summarizing that we have seen increase in use, and particularly around antipsychotic use in pediatric populations. We also see that many of these medications are being used for disruptive behavior disorders, not for schizophrenia or bipolar. And when you start using these medications for these non-indicated conditions, that's where some of the uncertainty is. What do we do with the child when we don't know what the definitive diagnosis, but they're having all of these problems? And also, the fact that we don't have prior exposure to other psychotropic meds prior before initiating that antipsychotic in that 1 year also begs to understand clinically what are some of the factors underlying that. Certainly there are limitations here. It's not nationally representative. The patterns that we see, unfortunately, do mirror what has been published in other studies. We also haven't really gone into some of the other non-pharmacologic treatments that are being used in addition to these treatment combinations. And we really don't understand this, know what the severity of the problems, of the underlying problems are. I'd like to think that if we can start looking at the number of changes, medication switches, and the complexity of those regimens over time, that should be a proxy for some of the underlying impairment morbidity, with the assumption that the more difficult, more severe, we have a harder time finding a stable treatment that keeps them on board. So these are just some of the next steps. This was a bit of work in progress, and we are going to pursue this treatment sequencing to understand more about what's happening over time and what are some of the factors that predict what happens next and why there's a medication switch. So I think I probably have used up a lot of my time, and I want to certainly save time for Dr. Zito's discussion on this topic. But I'll take any questions if there are some from the group.